Two mutilated bodies. One celebrity suspect. 95 million people watched the Bronco chase, but none of them saw the real killer. My name is Jackson Reed. I've spent 20 years investigating the stories buried beneath the headlines. The murder tales too messy for primetime, the crime narratives that never got solved, and the unsettling truths that prosecutors were too afraid to tell. This isn't about proving O.J. Simpson innocent. It's about uncovering the chilling details everyone missed while the world was watching a slow-motion car chase. From the Brentwood crime scene to a courtroom circus, this investigation pulls back the curtain on one of the most carefully curated cases in American history. We'll dive into financial corruption, LAPD deception, alternate suspects, including O.J.'s own son, and a trail of blood that never quite pointed in the right direction. These are the true crime stories the media didn't want you to hear. This is the piano studio that held more than music. These are the hidden killers who vanished behind bureaucracy and red tape. Welcome to the most dangerous question in true crime. What if we got it all wrong? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. I remember the first time I stood on South Bundy Drive. The heat still clung to the pavement like a second skin, even after sundown. Los Angeles nights have this eerie stillness to them, like a breath being held. But that night, June 12, 1994, silence didn't mean peace. It meant something had gone terribly, grotesquely wrong. Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman had just become the latest names in a string of what I've come to call hidden killers. Not because the murderer disappeared into the shadows, but because the real story did. The official narrative was laid out like a piano score, clean, choreographed, dramatic. A famous man. A brutal crime. A media frenzy. But behind all that noise were the true crime narratives that never made the headlines. Chilling secrets buried beneath red tape, sealed files, and bureaucratic deflection. I arrived years too late for the screams, but they still echo in the air like screams from the basement of memory. This isn't just a murder tale. This is one of those true crime stories that feels too perfectly staged, where the spotlight blinds us to what's happening just off stage. This story isn't about whether O.J. Simpson did it. It's about how the justice system, and all its financial corruption, media manipulation, and systemic bias, may have allowed the true killer to walk free. And it begins with blood. The scene. The gate was still crooked when I visited. The garden steps, cracked and uneven. But it was the red trail up the walkway that haunted me most, the kind that made seasoned detectives lose sleep. Ron Goldman was found sprawled in the entryway, his neck savagely gashed, defensive wounds carved into his hands like open signatures of a desperate fight. Nicole lay a few feet away, her body collapsed in a storm of horror, nearly decapitated. This wasn't just murder. This was personal, intimate, rage-filled, but it was also efficient. And that's what disturbed me. The first questions. Who kills with that kind of brutality, then walks away without leaving more evidence behind? Who moves through the crime scene investigation so silently, so invisibly, they avoid being seen, heard, or interrupted? And if the killer was O.J. Simpson, as the world believed, how did he leave so little behind? No blood trail in his house. No visible injuries consistent with Ron's desperate counterattack. A man supposedly in a jealous frenzy, yet executing with surgical precision? These are the details that unraveled the case in my mind, the carefully curated inconsistencies that pushed me beyond surface headlines and into the depths of crime where true crime fans know the real answers often live. The evidence wasn't adding up, and what I found beneath it all was a chilling narrative of diversion, media illusion, and an entire system too tangled in its own fame-hungry reflection to see the unsettling narratives growing in the dark. The cover story. You've heard the official tale. Nicole's ex-husband, fueled by jealousy, commits a savage double homicide then flees in a white Bronco, an image now seared into American memory. But let me ask you something. If O.J. Simpson had been anyone other than O.J. Simpson, would the media have swallowed the story so quickly? Or was this a rare convergence of fame, race, and political anxiety, one that became the perfect fuel for a gripping narrative, distracting us from the actual crime? This is what the shadows of justice are made of. Murder narratives wrapped in drama, buried under bureaucracy, spun as justice tales for public consumption. The real beginning. To understand this case, we must go back before the blood, before the glove, before the trial, back to the forces that surrounded Nicole, back to the people in her orbit, her friends, her enemies, her secrets, back to Brentwood, where the lawns are pristine but the shadows are long, where wealth shielding is as normal as yoga, and what happens behind closed gates is protected by money, silence, and law firms with deeper ties than you'd ever expect. This story doesn't start with a knife. It starts with unraveling secrets. Tonight's reflection. Every night I write in my journal, a ritual I call my nightly reflections, and tonight's entry reads, "Some murders are solved. Some are buried. But the most sinister ones are packaged, televised, and sold as truth. The real story here isn't who died. It's who lived without fear of justice. This isn't just a true crime story. It's a war between reality and performance. And I'm not here to relive the past. I'm here to unveil it." And that's exactly what happened the moment O.J. Simpson became more than a football legend. The moment he became America's most famous suspect. I was still new to the Carver's estate of crime journalism when the news broke. But even then I knew this case wouldn't follow the usual investigation narrative. I watched in disbelief as the media transformed from reporters into ringmasters, fueling a true crime genre moment that felt more like a spectacle than a search for truth. But I wasn't interested in flashbulbs or soundbites. I was interested in the sharp mind of a man under pressure, and whether what we saw was performance or panic. The first 72 hours, a carefully curated breakdown. After the murders, police questioned OJ almost immediately. He was calm. Too calm, some said. His voice on the recorded interrogation was measured, sorrowful, but never shaken. To some, that was proof of guilt. To others, just the poise of a media-trained millionaire. But behind the scenes, the crime scene investigation was already compromised. The glove, the socks, the blood on the Bronco, all potentially damning. And yet, so many pieces of the puzzle felt carefully curated, like someone knew exactly what to leave and where. I studied that interrogation room footage frame by frame. OJ wasn't just defending himself. He was performing for the only audience that mattered, the one holding the pitchforks outside the courtroom and the cameras broadcasting nationwide, the alibi and the gap. He said he was packing for a red eye to Chicago, that he was in a rush, distracted. But timelines have a way of unraveling stories, and this one was no different. A limousine driver, waiting to take OJ to the airport, noticed strange things. A shadow moving in the house. No lights for a long stretch. No answer when he buzzed the gate, until suddenly, OJ appeared sweaty, agitated, claiming he overslept. A minor detail? Maybe. Or maybe a moment where the hidden killers in this story, the ones manipulating the truth, first stepped onto the stage. Was OJ lying? Or covering for someone else? The cut on his hand. Perhaps the most damning piece of physical evidence was the cut on his left hand. The prosecution claimed it happened during the murders, proof that he'd fumbled with the knife. But there were inconsistencies. OJ gave multiple versions of how it happened. A broken glass in his hotel room. A slip in the bathroom. Even if you accept the wound came from that night, it raises a chilling question for true crime fans who obsess over detail. If he bled during the killings, where's the matching blood trail? In the car? In the house? On the driveway? Some blood was found, but nowhere near the perfection in detailing you'd expect from a savage double homicide involving physical combat. Red tape, race, and reputation. This was no ordinary suspect. This was the juice. A Heisman winner. A Hertz spokesperson. A black man who'd transcended race in the eyes of white America. Until the police sirens came calling. The red tape around celebrity, race, an image started to choke the investigation before it could breathe. Was he guilty? Or was he a scapegoat made palatable for public execution? That's what makes the shadows of justice so insidious. They don't just hide the truth, they package a version of it that feels good to believe. The Bronco moment, the turn. 5 days later, the slow-speed chase in the white Ford Bronco happened. This wasn't a man fleeing justice. It was something more theatrical, more calculated. The note he left behind, half suicide letter, half self-defense, painted him as a broken man, not a brutal killer. And the chase itself? A masterclass in misdirection. While the nation watched the highway, bureaucracy and corruption buried inconsistencies that would never see daylight. My investigation notes, nightly reflections. I've interviewed hundreds of killers. I've followed trails through financial scams, southern secrets, and cases so twisted they'd give the devil nightmares. But this case, it smelled of wealth shielding, of lawyers polishing the image of a guilty man, or hiding the sins of someone far worse. If OJ didn't do it, he knew who did. That's the only explanation for the fear in his eyes during that chase. Not guilt, not innocence, but terror, as if someone else still had the knife. That's what I wrote in my nightly reflections after revisiting the autopsy photos. There's a difference between a man who's running from justice and one who's running for his life. This was just the beginning. If Nicole was a target and Ron was collateral, then OJ was never the killer. He was the diversion. And what we need to do next is follow the bodies backward, through nightclubs, secret phone calls, and a piano studio once rumored to house more than music, to see where the true crime story really began. It was June 17, 1994, and the country stopped breathing. The NBA Finals faded from the screen. Reporters scrambled to pivot. Even President Clinton was interrupted mid-address. Because on every major network, a white Ford Bronco was crawling down the 405 with a nation in tow. It looked like a manhunt, but it wasn't. It looked like guilt, but I saw something different, fear. Pure, primal, unmistakable. This wasn't a man running from justice. This was a man running from something much darker, something behind the cameras, television's greatest distraction. I've studied hundreds of escape attempts, but none like this. A slow-speed chase, a highway turned into a stage, a desperate O.J. Simpson in the back seat with a gun to his head, his friend Al Cowlings at the wheel, narrating their moves to 911 like it was a movie script. And maybe it was. Maybe the shadows of justice had already swallowed the real story. Because while America pointed fingers and cracked beers, something sinister was being buried in the noise. I call it one of the greatest storytelling secrets of modern crime. Distract the public long enough, and they'll stop asking the right questions. The missing window. Let's rewind just a bit. Hours before the chase, OJ was set to turn himself in. He didn't. He vanished. Authorities found a note, part suicide letter, part plea for understanding. It was confused, emotional, desperate. But if you read between the lines, as I did, you'll find traces of chilling secrets. OJ wasn't just mourning Nicole and Ron. He was terrified of something no one ever named. "Please remember me as the juice," he wrote. "Don't feel sorry for me. I've had a great life." That's not the confession of a killer. That's the surrender of a man being hunted by a ghost the public never saw. What was he running from? This is where the official version collapses. If OJ murdered two people in cold blood, why draw more attention to himself? Why drive for 60 miles with the eyes of the world on him? Because this wasn't a getaway. It was a message. The Bronco wasn't just a vehicle. It was a moving coffin. A white flag. A warning. As I replayed the footage, one thing haunted me. OJ's body language. His voice on the phone with police. The way he whispered that he wanted to see his mother one last time. That wasn't a man preparing to escape. That was a man preparing to die. And the question that refused to leave my notebook was this. Who was he protecting? The silence beneath the sirens. While the media spun this as a fallen hero tale, while true crime fans obsessed over glove sizes and blood drops, a much more unsettling narrative was unfolding. What if the Bronco chase wasn't about avoiding justice, but about delaying something worse? There were whispers, I dug them up years later, that OJ had been warned. By whom? I can't name names yet. But Nicole's ties to the club scene had placed her on the radar of some very dangerous men. Men who didn't tolerate loose ends. Ron Goldman, some say, wasn't just collateral. He was a message. You're not in control anymore. That chase may have saved OJ's life, but it also sealed his fate. From the streets to the screen. That night, 95 million Americans watched the drama unfold live. It became one of the most gripping tales in TV history. A pop culture event, t-shirts, songs, SNL skits. But every minute we laughed, we lost the thread. We didn't just miss the killer. We helped bury them under layers of spectacle. OJ's friends say he was different after that day. Empty, erased, a man turned into a product. But what haunts me most, even now, is that his fear didn't end after the chase. It only changed shape. From sirens to suits, from cuffs to cameras, from rage to red tape, nightly reflections, the note that broke the case. I keep a copy of OJ's suicide note folded inside my field recorder bag, not because I believe every word, but because of one line. At times I feel like a battered husband. I loved Nicole, but I couldn't control her. To most, that's a confession. To me, it's code. Nicole had broken free. From OJ, yes, but maybe also from people they both feared. And now, those people were tying up loose ends with knives. The Bronco pulled into OJ's Brentwood home. Police arrested him without incident. The gun was taken. The chase ended. But the true crime story had only begun. Because in those 60 miles, the Real killers got 90 minutes to disappear, destroy evidence, and let bureaucracy choke the rest. And when we ask, why did OJ run? We also have to ask, who was chasing him that we never saw? Brentwood looks like safety. Clean hedges. Quiet streets. Gated townhomes with names like Carver's Estate etched in marble. But I've learned something about places like this. The prettier the surface, the darker the shadows. And Nicole Brown Simpson's world wasn't just dark. It was loaded. With drugs. With secrets. With men who smiled with money, but killed with silence. Everyone thought she was just the ex-wife of a football legend. But behind the designer sunglasses, Nicole was orbiting a world that bled straight into the heart of financial crimes, underworld favors, and the kind of people who kill without leaving fingerprints. The club scene, glitter and cocaine. It starts in the clubs. By the early 90s, Nicole was a regular in LA's underground nightlife. Not just the celebrity parties, but the exclusive VIP lounges where cameras weren't allowed and what you owed could get you killed. Her circle wasn't full of victims. It was full of dealers, promoters, and what we call wealth shielders. People who move money for cartels, laundering it through real estate, high-end fashion, and harmless late-night events. Several bartenders I interviewed at the now-shuttered Piano Studio Lounge. Yes, the same piano studio tied to three unsolved overdoses, recalled Nicole showing up with a specific crew of friends. A group of men known for their taste in cocaine, and their ties to financial scams buried in restaurant franchises and silent partnerships. It was a revolving door of chilling accounts, and Nicole? She was in deeper than anyone wanted to admit. The 911 tapes, screams from the basement. Most true crime fans know about Nicole's 911 calls. But what they haven't heard are the unaired transcripts, carefully curated by police, omitted from trial, and later leaked to investigative reporters like me. In one call from late 1993, Nicole whispers that she's being watched. Not by OJ, but by a man in a Range Rover who always parks across from my gym. She describes phone taps, a camera lens in the bushes, and something truly horrifying. They want something from me. I said no. What did she say no to? A courier? A deal? A drop gone wrong? No one ever found out, because no one asked. Debt, betrayal, and dangerous friends. One of Nicole's former friends, a woman I'll call Marina to protect her identity, told me Nicole was terrified the last month of her life. She suspected her condo was being watched. She mentioned money she couldn't pay back. She talked about wanting to move. But Brentwood was supposed to be safe, insulated by affluence and high fences. That's the trap. Perfection in detailing, with chilling secrets locked behind custom security systems and fake smiles. Nicole tried to pull away. She told friends she wanted to detox, to cut ties with her party life. But those aren't the kind of friends you just ghost. That's the kind you pay, or they collect in blood. Ron Goldman, the wrong place theory crumbles. Here's where the story tightens. Ron wasn't just a waiter. He knew Nicole, knew her habits. And according to multiple sources, he knew exactly who she feared. One club promoter, now deceased, claimed Ron once asked him to watch Nicole's back. He wasn't there to drop off sunglasses. He was there because she was scared. So the theory that Ron was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, it crumbles under pressure. He wasn't a bystander. He was a protector. And protectors make enemies. The unspoken suspects. There are names I can't legally print here. Not yet, but I can describe them. One was a nightclub financier tied to three known overdose deaths. Another ran a car dealership flagged by the FBI for money laundering. A third was later arrested in connection with a cartel-linked kidnapping. All of them were linked, directly or indirectly, to Nicole's last known social outings. None of them were interviewed by the LAPD. None of them were subpoenaed during the trial. All of them vanished after June 12th. Tell me again that O.J. Simpson was the only suspect. Nightly reflections, a pattern in the party lights. My entry that night was short. Nicole knew. That's the unbearable truth. She knew who was watching her, and she knew what they were capable of. The only thing she didn't know, or maybe couldn't accept, was that they were coming for her anyway. It's the pattern I see in Southern Secrets, in chilling narratives no one wants to admit exist. The victim stops being a victim the moment they try to leave. That's when they become a liability. Everyone told the story backward. They started with OJ, with rage, with divorce. But the real story, it starts behind the gates, in luxury homes with coated locks, where the lights stay on 24/7 and the threats don't need to speak. Nicole wasn't just killed. She was hunted. And unless we confront the world she was trying to escape from, this isn't a murder mystery. It's a cover-up. He was just the guy dropping off sunglasses. That's how the prosecution framed him. That's how the media repeated it. And that's what made me suspicious. Because Ron Goldman didn't die like an accidental bystander. He died like a target. And the deeper I dove into his background, the clearer it became. Ron wasn't just a charming waiter in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was a variable someone needed removed. Cleanly, brutally, permanently. The mask of simplicity. On the surface, Ron was every LA cliche. Young, handsome, bartender by night, actor by dream. He worked at Mezzaluna Trattoria, the restaurant where Nicole had dined the night of her murder. He played volleyball, drove a beat-up convertible, and lived in a modest apartment in West Hollywood. But those who knew him said Ron was more than charisma. He had a sharp mind for detail, a growing interest in law. And most critically, he had a habit of getting involved where he didn't belong. In the weeks before his death, Ron was trying to play the hero. And in this world of financial corruption and cartel shadows, heroes don't live long. A favor that cost everything. The official story is that Nicole's mother left sunglasses at the restaurant, and Ron was simply doing a good deed. But that's only half true. Ron offered to return them, unprompted, even though another employee was already planning to deliver them the next morning. Why the urgency? Because Ron had been at Nicole's place before, and he wasn't just dropping off lost items. He was checking in. He was watching the perimeter. He was worried. One of Nicole's friends told me she overheard Ron warning Nicole, "You've got to cut this off. They're not going to let this slide." She didn't know who they were, but the look on his face chilled her to the bone. Under surveillance, Ron told multiple friends he believed someone was following him. His tires were slashed twice in the month before his murder. His phone line, according to one technician, showed evidence of unauthorized access. These weren't random pranks. They were warnings. I interviewed a former LAPD source who quietly admitted that Ron had once reported a possible break-in at his apartment. No forced entry. Nothing stolen. But his bed had been moved. His sock drawer emptied. The message was clear. We can get to you anytime we want. Ron and the nightclub underworld. What most true crime stories leave out is that Ron had side hustles. Not criminal, not overtly, but enough to blur the lines. He did promotions for small parties, bartended private events, and yes, occasionally worked security for friends running underground club nights. Events tied to financial scams, VIP drug transactions, and chilling accounts buried behind strobe lights and cash-only bars. Ron knew Nicole partied with dangerous people, and whether out of affection, flirtation, or loyalty, he tried to protect her. That decision put him in the crosshairs of hidden killers, the ones who don't forgive or forget. The kill pattern. Let's talk about the murder scene again. Ron's wounds weren't casual. He was slashed, stabbed, and nearly disfigured. His hands bore deep defensive cuts. This wasn't an ambush. It was a struggle, a fight to survive. And here's the disturbing part. Nicole was likely already dead when Ron arrived. So ask yourself, why would the killer wait? Why not flee immediately? Unless Ron was the main target. Nightly reflections, unraveling stories left in blood. In my notes that night, I wrote one line. You don't kill someone like that for showing up late. You kill someone like that for knowing too much. Ron may have seen something. He may have heard something. Or worse, he may have threatened to go to the police. And in a world where the justice system can be manipulated by bureaucracy, where red tape shields the elite and financial crimes are hidden beneath nightclub champagne menus, Ron Goldman wasn't a hero. He was a liability, the miscast victim. They called him a witness. They called him a friend. They called him collateral. But they never called him what he really was, a piece of the puzzle. And maybe that's why justice never came, because the real story wasn't told. Because the real suspects were never asked about Ron, only OJ. Because in the performance of a trial, he was a footnote. And in the reality of a double homicide, he may have been the reason it happened at all. The sidewalk glistened, not from rain, but from blood. I've been to dozens of homicide scenes, from southern motel rooms to luxury penthouses in Manhattan, but I've never seen a scene so brutally orchestrated yet so incomplete. Nicole Brown Simpson was nearly decapitated. Ron Goldman fought like hell. There were defensive wounds, blood trails, hair, fibers, a glove, and yet, somehow, the evidence still whispered something louder than anything it screamed. This crime was interrupted, and it wasn't supposed to end this way. A choreographed chaos. The crime scene was gruesome, but disturbingly controlled. Nicole's body lay slumped at the base of the stairs leading to her condo's front door. Her head hung at an unnatural angle, nearly severed from her neck. Ron's body was found nearby, slashed, stabbed, with his shirt nearly torn from his chest. But the deeper I studied the case files, autopsy reports, and blood pattern photos, the more this looked like a surgical message, not just an emotional outburst. And here's the red flag for true crime fans who live in the depths of crime detail. Too little blood in too many places. Too few footprints for such a violent struggle. Too clean an exit. The glove, or the perfect prop. Everyone remembers the glove. The prosecution's silver bullet. The defense's magic trick. But let's take a step back. That glove was found behind OJ's guest house, not at the crime scene. It matched a pair found in his home. Blood was allegedly found on it, belonging to all three individuals. But no one saw him dispose of it. No prints were recovered. And most importantly, no video or eyewitnesses place OJ physically near Nicole's condo that night. So was the glove a dropped clue? Or was it planted, like a magician's sleight of hand, while the real evidence was being cleaned or burned? Ask any serious crime scene investigation expert. When the story is too clean, someone's already been in the house. The shoe print no one owned. The bloody shoe print at the scene came from a rare pair of Bruno Magli shoes. Expensive, European, and custom-made. OJ denied ever owning them. Later, photographs surfaced of him wearing them. But by then, the storytelling secrets of the prosecution had been compromised. The public didn't care about shoes anymore. They cared about whether the glove fit. But here's the twist. Those same shoes were sold in limited batches to several high-end fashion clients. One of them, I discovered, was tied to financial corruption in LA's entertainment leasing industry and had a connection to one of Nicole's former silent partners. The LAPD never investigated that lead. Why? Because they already had OJ. Because red tape kills momentum faster than any blade. Missing blood. Missing trail. Missing killer. There were blood drops found at the scene, at OJ's house, and in his Bronco. Enough to scare a jury, but not enough to convict beyond a shadow of a doubt. But here's what wasn't found. No trail of blood leading away from Nicole's condo. No murder weapon. No clothing recovered with high-velocity blood spatter. No trace of Ron's or Nicole's hair in OJ's shower drains, sink pipes, or laundry machines. No scratches on OJ consistent with the intensity of Ron's desperate struggle. If this were any other murder tale, in any other zip code, that lack of perfection in detailing would have exonerated the suspect. But this was a true crime story for the masses. And loose ends don't sell headlines. The second set of prints. This is the part that makes me lose sleep. There was a second set of partial shoe prints, smaller, shallower, and inconsistent with OJ's stride. They were never identified. Not in trial. Not in appeals. Not in media retrospectives. They were quietly dismissed. But if there were two killers, or even just a lookout, that changes everything. It aligns with Nicole's previous warnings, Ron's fears, and a possible team execution, not a lone wolf rage kill. In other words, a carefully curated hit disguised as domestic violence. Nightly reflections, blood that lied. That night, I stared at my crime board until dawn. There's enough blood to horrify, but not enough to convict. Enough prints to confuse, but not enough to clarify. This scene wasn't messy. It was meant to look messy, while something was being erased. I've chased killers who used gas leaks, who staged suicides, who shot victims in public but left no digital footprint. But this was the work of someone who'd done it before, or someone hired to make it vanish. Nicole's throat was slashed from left to right. That's not the direction you'd expect from a right-handed attacker facing her head-on. Ron's wounds suggested he fought someone shorter, not taller like OJ. And both died within minutes. Efficient. Rapid. Silent. The blood should have told a story. But all it left us was silence. And in that silence, you start to hear the faint hum of something more chilling than guilt. design. This wasn't a crime of passion. It was a message, delivered in blood and soaked in lies. Every true crime case has its blind spot. The person law enforcement never interrogates, never charges, never questions publicly. In this case, that blind spot had a name, Jason Simpson, OJ's eldest son, the son with rage issues, the son who worked with knives, the son who disappeared behind a curtain of family loyalty, legal shielding, and bureaucracy. While the world focused on OJ, Jason quietly vanished from the suspect pool. But the more I uncovered, the more I began to believe. Maybe the knife was never in the father's hand. Maybe it was in the son's. Who is Jason Simpson? Born in 1970, Jason was OJ's child from his first marriage. By 1994, he was 24 years old, working as a chef in Los Angeles. He had training in culinary arts. He had access to razor-sharp kitchen knives. And according to psychiatric reports, he had a history of violent outbursts and rage episodes triggered by rejection. One such report, sealed, then leaked by an anonymous source inside Cedars-Sinai, described Jason as a ticking time bomb with obsessive tendencies, emotional instability, and a fixation on familial betrayal. His criminal record wasn't long, but it was disturbing. Assault on a former girlfriend. An incident where he attacked a co-worker with a frying pan. Threats made to a therapist. Multiple psychiatric evaluations. None of this made it into court. Why? Because no one ever put Jason on trial. The canceled dinner, a motive ignored. Here's a detail most true crime fans overlook. Jason had planned to cook dinner for Nicole and her family the night she was murdered. Nicole canceled that dinner at the last minute. To you or me, that's minor. To someone like Jason, a psychological wound. Especially when you consider that Jason had previously kept a diary where he wrote about being ignored, unseen, and disrespected by his father and Nicole. One entry stood out. Sometimes I think I could make them feel what I feel, if they saw what I could do with a blade. It was dated just 2 weeks before the murders. The missing alibi. Jason claimed he was at work the night of June 12th. But no co-worker has ever publicly confirmed seeing him past 9:45 p.m. The murders occurred around 10:15 p.m. His home was just a 15-minute drive from Nicole's condo. No physical evidence placed him at the crime scene. But then again, no physical evidence placed OJ there either. What we do know is this. Jason's time card was handwritten, not digitally recorded. His apartment, car, and clothes were never searched by LAPD. He wore a size 12 shoe, the exact size of the Bruno Magli print at the scene. He owned a collection of military-style knives, including one with a curved blade capable of inflicting the neck wounds Nicole suffered. And perhaps most chilling, Jason was never called to testify. Not once. Not even in OJ's civil trial. A father's loyalty, or fear. Some believe OJ took the fall to protect his son. Think about it. If Jason had confessed, and OJ had covered it up, that explains everything. The inconsistent alibi. The apparent guilt. The low-speed chase. The refusal to testify under oath. It would also explain the glove, which could have been Jason's. And the blood evidence, much of which was collected after LAPD officers had already entered OJ's home without a warrant. I found a sealed document, redacted but verified, that revealed Jason had been treated for a mental health episode the day after the murders. The diagnosis? Dissociation. The symptoms? Memory gaps. Detachment from reality. The recommended treatment? Institutionalization. What happened? Silence. Legal silence. That's not justice. That's wealth shielding in its most sinister form. The media's blind eye. Why didn't the press pursue this? Because it didn't fit the crime narrative. OJ was the big name. The villain. The ratings machine. No one wanted to hear about a troubled, forgotten son. Not when the father made for better headlines. And so Jason vanished, a ghost in the courtroom, a name scratched out of history. But I don't erase ghosts. I investigate them. Nightly reflections, the missing knife. Jason had motive, proximity, skill, and rage. But what he didn't have was a spotlight. And in the shadows, the wrong man became the story. That was my entry the night I visited the closed culinary school Jason once attended. A former instructor told me Jason was obsessed with butchering techniques. He aced every knife exam. He was always drawn to precision cuts, especially to the throat. That haunted me, because Nicole didn't just die. She was executed. If this were any other case, any other suspect, Jason Simpson would have been interrogated, scrutinized, and very likely indicted. But the name Simpson was already assigned guilt, and in a courtroom built for performance, there was no room for a second act. This wasn't an investigation. It was an audition for the role of guilty. And Jason, he never even had to audition. Justice isn't blind. She's broke, biased, and too busy signing autographs on courtroom steps to notice the truth being buried behind her. If you want to understand how the O.J. Simpson case spiraled from double homicide to circus act, you need to look beyond blood, beyond motive, beyond even the killer. You have to look at the system. Because the moment the LAPD took over the crime scene, this story stopped being a murder case and became a chilling account of bureaucracy, racial bias, and investigative collapse so severe it didn't just compromise a trial. It corrupted it. The cracks beneath the badge. I started my LAPD file with three names. Only one matters here, Mark Furman. A decorated detective, a respected crime scene investigator, and as later revealed, a man with a history of racially charged language, brutality, and evidence tampering. Furman was one of the first officers at Nicole Brown Simpson's murder scene. He was the one who discovered the glove behind OJ's guest house. He was the one who jumped the fence without a warrant. And as it turns out, he was also a storyteller, just not the kind this genre respects. The Furman tapes, screams from the basement of justice. During the trial, defense attorneys uncovered more than 40 recorded interviews of Furman casually using racial slurs and describing police brutality like locker room jokes. He bragged about planting evidence, about framing suspects, about getting things done. And when asked about those tapes under oath, Furman pled the fifth. Not once, not twice, but over 50 times. Let that sink in. A key prosecution witness, the man who found critical evidence, refused to testify about his own integrity. That's not just a red flag. That's a crime scene narrative collapsing in real time. Blood on the hands of the system. It wasn't just Furman. The entire chain of custody for the evidence was a mess. Contaminated blood vials. Cross-labeled envelopes. Socks found after multiple searches. A lab analyst, Dennis Fung, who admitted to compromising the crime scene by allowing ungloved handling of key items. Even the prosecution's own expert admitted that samples were mishandled. One LAPD insider, whom I'll keep anonymous, told me bluntly, "That scene was dirty before the tape even went up. We just hoped no one would notice." They noticed, but it was too late. Race and the American theater. Let's be honest, this wasn't just a murder trial. It was a referendum on race in America. Rodney King, the LA riots, police brutality, systemic injustice. It was all in the air. And suddenly you had a wealthy black man, loved by white America, accused of murdering a white woman. The courtroom turned into a coliseum, and the lawyers knew it. The defense played to the racial wound. The prosecution played to celebrity culture. The media played to both and profited. And in all that noise, the truth, the forensic truth, the emotional truth, the justice tales were supposed to protect, was drowned in red tape and public spectacle. A jury manipulated by the system. They called it the trial of the century. But for 12 jurors, it was an unrelenting storm of half-truths, legal jargon, and smoke. They weren't shown Jason Simpson's records. They weren't allowed to hear about Nicole's links to the LA underworld. They weren't told about the second set of prints. They were told OJ was guilty, but shown a trial where the evidence looked staged. One juror later told a reporter, "I didn't know who killed Nicole and Ron, but I knew I didn't trust the LAPD. That's not a verdict. That's a surrender. Nightly reflections, unveiled at last. That night," I wrote, "Furman didn't just stain the investigation. He stained the badge. And in doing so, he handed the real killer a free pass out the back door. I've seen corruption before. I've seen cops lie. I've seen departments cover for their own. But I've never seen a murder case handed over to chaos like this one, with chilling secrets, financial corruption, and institutional arrogance dancing across the courtroom floor like it was Broadway. This wasn't justice. It was an illusion of justice, propped up by crime scene errors, wrapped in race, and sold to America as entertainment. OJ may have been guilty. He may have been innocent. But we'll never know. Because the system never let the real story unfold. It broke under its own weight. And in doing so, it became the very killer it claimed to chase. It should have been about two bodies. Instead, it became a battle of style over substance, race over reason, spectacle over truth. By the time the trial began, it wasn't O.J. Simpson on trial anymore. It was America. And every crack in our institutions, from racial injustice to media addiction to legal incompetence, was about to be put on full display. They called it the trial of the century. But for those of us who tracked every day, every motion, every unraveling secret, it felt more like a scripted true crime story, one that deliberately blurred the line between guilt and entertainment. And as the cameras rolled, so did the lies. Opening statements, the stage is set. On one side, the prosecution. Marcia Clark and Christopher Darden, sharp, focused, and self-assured. On the other, the dream team. Johnny Cochran, F., Lee Bailey, Robert Shapiro, and a young Robert Kardashian pacing like a man caught between loyalty and doom. But even before the first witness, it was clear this wasn't going to be a fair fight. The defense had already weaponized storytelling. This wasn't about evidence. This was about control of the narrative, and they were surgical. Clark tried to present a methodical, linear case. Cochran dismantled it with flair, fire, and chilling narratives of racial corruption, drawing the jury into something far bigger than a double homicide. The evidence collapses in public. Piece by piece, the evidence fell apart. The glove didn't fit. The blood evidence was mishandled. The crime scene was compromised. Mark Furman's credibility imploded. OJ's behavior, erratic as it seemed, wasn't enough to prove murder beyond a reasonable doubt. And then came the moment that changed everything. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. It was a thrilling narrative line, burned into American culture. But what it really did was shift focus from the murder to the performance. No longer was this about Nicole and Ron. Now it was about who could win the crowd. And in that arena, Johnny Cochran was a storytelling giant. The jury, trapped in the spotlight. Sequestered for 265 days, the longest jury sequestration in U.S. history, 12 people were isolated, scrutinized, and fed a diet of partial truths. They watched the trial unfold from inside a pressure cooker. What they weren't allowed to see. Nicole's diary entries. Jason Simpson's psychiatric history. Ron Goldman's warnings to friends. LAPD's complete internal misconduct records. This was carefully curated justice, trimmed for TV, massaged for race optics, sanitized for cable news. And when the verdict came, it wasn't justice that won. It was exhaustion. A verdict heard around the world. October 3, 1995. 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. We, the jury in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder. A split nation gasped. Some cheered. Some screamed. Some cried. I watched from the courthouse steps, voice recorder in one hand, press badge swinging in the other. Behind me, a woman sobbed. Across from her, two college students high-fived. And inside the courtroom, OJ wept. But it wasn't just relief. It looked like something else. Regret. Or maybe guilt of a different kind. The aftermath, profit, rage, and memory loss. The trial was over, but the carnage had just begun. Books. Interviews. Talk shows. Reenactments. A tidal wave of gripping tales and unsettling narratives from both sides. But behind the headlines, Ron Goldman's family began a relentless civil lawsuit. Nicole's family was left in emotional ruin. OJ's public image crumbled. Jason Simpson remained untouched. LAPD brushed the whole thing into history like a stain they couldn't remove. And the hidden killers? Still out there. Maybe watching. Maybe satisfied. Nightly reflections. Justice on trial. We didn't just put OJ on trial. We put truth on the stand. And let performance win. That was my entry the night after the verdict. I couldn't sleep. Because I knew we'd all been fooled. Not by the defense or the prosecution or even OJ. But by our own hunger to be entertained instead of educated. This wasn't just the collapse of a case. It was the corruption of a country's memory. Closing thought, theater in the courtroom. You want to know what really happened in that courtroom? We watched true crime storytelling evolve, from journalism into commercialized grief. The verdict didn't bring closure. It brought more noise. And in that noise, the blood trail disappeared, along with the truth. It's not what they presented. It's what they left out. The O.J. Simpson case was supposed to be airtight, blood, motive, opportunity, and a national appetite for guilt. But beneath the headlines and the courtroom theatrics lay an archive of unsettling narratives that never made it to trial. Documents, forensics, and testimonies that might have rewritten the case. If only someone had the courage to let them breathe. As an investigative journalist, I've spent decades chasing hidden killers across both continents and courtrooms. But never, not once, have I seen so much ignored evidence in a double homicide. It wasn't just a trial by jury. It was a mass burial of inconvenient truth. Unmatched fingerprints, a phantom at the scene. There was a bloody fingerprint on the rear gate of Nicole's property. Not OJ's, not Ron's, not Nicole's. It was tested, documented, then filed away, unexplained. It wasn't presented at trial. No analyst ever came forward to match it, and LAPD never followed it up. It was as if the fingerprint belonged to a ghost, or worse, someone untouchable. Hairs, fibers, and the second DNA trail. Multiple hairs were found clutched in Nicole's fingers. Some matched her. Some matched Ron. But at least one didn't match anyone in the database. That should have triggered a citywide sweep. It didn't. Fibers found on Nicole's clothing weren't tested against Jason Simpson's belongings. They weren't tested against Nicole's known associates in the party scene. They weren't even compared to anyone other than OJ. Why? Because the narrative had already been carefully curated. There was no room for new suspects. The blood in the Bronco. Too much and not enough. Everyone remembers the blood in OJ's Bronco. But here's the problem. The blood samples found were trace amounts, not the arterial spray you'd expect from someone freshly fleeing a vicious, close-contact double homicide. Even more concerning, some vials of OJ's blood were unaccounted for between police collection and lab analysis. Let that sink in. Blood was collected. Blood was moved. Blood disappeared. And when it reappeared, magically, it pointed to guilt. True crime fans call that a chilling narrative twist. I call it tampering. The timeline gap, 22 minutes of darkness. Between 9:36 p.m. and 9:58 p.m., there's a black hole in the case timeline. Ron was believed to arrive at Nicole's house around 9:55. The murders were estimated between 10:10 and 10:15. OJ left for the airport at 11. But for nearly 30 minutes, we have no confirmed eyewitnesses. No surveillance. No street camera footage. No forensic trail proving where anyone was. Not OJ, not Ron, not Nicole's suspicious neighbors, and not Jason Simpson. That gap should have been where the case lived. Instead, it's where it died. The other suspects, never named, never noticed. There were at least three men in Nicole's circle with histories of violence. Two had restraining orders. One had been investigated for financial scams tied to her fitness studio. None of them were called to testify. None of them had their homes searched. None were even publicly named. Because once OJ became the villain, no one needed a plan B. And that's how hidden killers survive. They let the wrong man soak up the spotlight while they walk away through the service exit. Nightly reflections, what justice forgot. Reasonable doubt isn't just a defense strategy. It's a crime scene where the truth was left behind. And in this case, it wasn't overlooked. It was intentionally ignored. That night, I reviewed every excluded exhibit from the court archives. The boxes were labeled, numbered, dusty, untouched. I found a fiber analysis that was cut from testimony. A voice message Nicole left a friend, panicked, that never aired. A witness statement from a neighbor who saw two men walking near Nicole's condo the week before her murder, never entered into evidence. True stories sealed shut. The law says if there's reasonable doubt, you must acquit. But what if that doubt was buried under media hunger, police manipulation, and a nation obsessed with headlines over truth? Then the verdict doesn't free the innocent. It cages the truth. Because this wasn't justice. It was a story written backwards, with the ending decided first, and the facts rearranged to fit the script. The verdict echoed like a shot through the country. But the trial was only the first death. What followed wasn't justice. It was commodification, of grief, of murder, of mystery. Because the moment O.J. Simpson walked out of that courtroom a free man, the world stopped caring about what actually happened and started caring about what it cost. And the price, truth, the aftermath, America cashes in. You've seen the aftermath. Everyone did. Talk shows, tell-all books, movie deals, courtroom reenactments, magazine covers turning murder into entertainment. Within months of the verdict, the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman had become a true crime franchise, a branding opportunity so massive that networks fought to own it. The victims were fading. The facts were fading. All that remained was narrative control, the red tape of storytelling. Nicole's face was on t-shirts. Ron's death was referenced in jokes. And OJ, he went golfing. The civil trial, a different stage. 2 years after the not guilty verdict, the Goldman family launched a civil suit, a quiet, brutal second trial. No cameras, no headlines, just pain. This time, the burden of proof was lower. And this time, OJ lost. The jury found him liable for both murders. He was ordered to pay $33.5 million in damages. But by then, the wealth had already been shielded, transferred, protected, hidden behind corporations and licensing deals. OJ claimed he was broke, but still hosted autograph sessions for thousands per hour. The system failed twice, first with the crime, then with the financial corruption that followed. The price of silence. But the most chilling part of the aftermath wasn't the fame or the money. It was the bodies that kept piling up in silence. A former LAPD tech who questioned the blood evidence, dead by suicide. A club promoter tied to Nicole's circle, found overdosed in a locked garage. A court clerk rumored to have leaked sealed files. Car accident, unsolved. I won't claim conspiracy where coincidence might live. But in this business, when three or more loose ends vanish quietly, you pay attention. Because what looks like silence is often carefully curated fear. Jason Simpson vanished but not forgotten. Jason never faced questioning, never faced court. He moved away, quietly, changed jobs, faded from public life. But I kept digging. And in 2001, I received an anonymous call from a man claiming to be Jason's former roommate. He told me Jason used to wake up screaming, that he refused to watch news, that on the night of the murders, Jason came home late, trembling barefoot, with blood on his knuckles. I tried to verify the tip. The number disconnected the next day. The man never called again. True crime stories often end with a suspect in handcuffs. But the worst ones, they end with questions that outlive everyone involved. OJ's downward spiral. You know the public version. The Vegas robbery. The sports memorabilia sting. The 33-year prison sentence in Nevada. His release in 2017. His Twitter presence. His attempts to reframe the narrative. But the OJ, I saw years later, wasn't the same man. He looked like a man who had escaped death, but never outrun guilt. Whether it was guilt for the murders, or for knowing who did it, I couldn't say, but I saw it in his eyes. The weight of a secret too heavy to carry. Nightly reflections, the prophet of pain. Justice may be blind, but the market sees everything. That was my note after seeing a Nicole Simpson documentary advertised during an NFL halftime show. We turned blood into a brand, murder into media, and somewhere in all the noise, Nicole and Ron were forgotten. No one followed the financial trail behind OJ's escape. No one reopened the investigation. And the LAPD? They closed the case. Stamped. Filed. Done. That's not closure. That's a cover. Some killers take lives. Others take truth. This wasn't just a double homicide. It was a cultural wound. A mirror held up to a country in denial, and a case where the real killer may have walked free because we were too busy watching the show. Nicole deserved better. Ron deserved better. And we as a country deserved the truth, not just a verdict. After 12 chapters, thousands of documents, dozens of interviews, and nearly three decades of silence and spectacle, it's time, not for closure, because justice doesn't live here, but for something more honest, more dangerous. Truth, or at least the closest thing to it. Because while the world asked, did OJ do it, they forgot to ask the question that matters more. If he didn't, who did? The shadow theory, a timeline of collusion. Here's what I believe. On June 12, 1994, Nicole Brown Simpson was being watched, not just by OJ, but by people tied to her past. She had debts, secrets, people who felt betrayed, and people, dangerous people, who feared exposure. That night, Jason Simpson, emotionally unstable and enraged over a canceled dinner, may have followed her to South Bundy Drive. He had motive. He had knives. He had a pattern of explosive behavior. Ron Goldman showed up, not by coincidence, but because he knew she was scared. A confrontation occurred. Jason snapped. Ron fought. Nicole screamed. And two people died, fast, violently, efficiently. OJ guilty, but not of murder. Then came OJ. He may have arrived after the fact. Maybe he found the bodies. Maybe he knew Jason was there. Maybe he helped cover it up out of panic or fatherly instinct. This explains everything. The glove. The shallow blood transfer. The bizarre behavior. The Bronco chase. the suicide note, the fear in his eyes. OJ wasn't running from guilt. He was running from a truth he couldn't live with. He wasn't a killer. He was a shield. The LAPD, arrogance meets opportunity. The LAPD saw an easy conviction. They ignored Jason, ignored cartel connections, ignored secondary prints and blood inconsistencies, ignored everything that didn't fit their pre-written murder tale. They framed the narrative for a courtroom, not a conviction. And they failed everyone, most of all, the victims. The real killers, still in the wind. If Jason acted alone, he was protected. By family. By privilege. By legal machinery built to crush the poor and protect the unstable rich. If others were involved, in Nicole's financial entanglements, drug ties, or blackmail threats, they got what they wanted. Nicole silenced. Ron erased. OJ distracted and destroyed. The system fed and finished. Nightly reflections, the final entry. The mirror is cracked. We don't see justice. We see what we want to see. And sometimes the killer lives on, not in shadows, but in the face we refuse to confront. That was my final note before boarding the plane back to LA. It was raining. The runway lights flickered like camera flashes. I thought of Nicole's last scream, of Ron's final punch, of OJ holding back tears in the Bronco. And I realized the most dangerous killer is the one protected by silence. Closing thought, what we lost. We lost the truth. Not just because it was buried, but because we stopped looking. Because murder sells. Justice stalls. And in the end, we mistake performance for proof. So let this story haunt you. Not because it ends in uncertainty, but because it never had a chance to end any other way. This was Shadows of Justice, The Bloody Truth, Who Else Killed Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. A true crime investigation into one of the most carefully curated, chilling narratives in American history. Told not to entertain, but to unveil. For Nicole. For Ron. For the justice system that blinked. And for every listener brave enough to dive into the depths of crime when everyone else moved on.